Okay, we are past 7:30, so I'm going to mute all. As per usual, you have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the deck in PDF form, the contents of the chat window, and the audio track will go up on our website. And we have a fair number of items tonight to go through, so I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So starting off, we have a follow-up from Jeff Dubois. Yeah, he was talking about this, I think, last week, that he'd received a text message, and all it said was deep link. And he didn't click on it, but he checked, and there was nothing behind it, so he was wondering what it was. He thought it was a redirection link that's used in marketing. And sure enough, if you check online, that's exactly what it is. So it kind of works two ways. If you have the app installed on your device, then it takes you off to some specific portion of an app you're using, i.e., let's say the checkout if you're in some kind of shopping app. And if the app isn't installed, then the link takes you off and wants to install the app. And once you've installed the app, then it takes you to the checkout. So in pretty pictures, it basically works like this. You click on the link, and if you have the app, then it wanders over here to where it's supposed to go. And if you don't have the app, then it comes down here and does the install. However, there was nothing there, so it looked like a scam. And I just remind you from our Fraud Watch page that, as it says, not all scams arrive by email or by telephone. And there's a whole raft of text messaging fraud alerts. You can see some of them there. There's no one to sign for your parcel. A pending deposit, all you have to do is click right here. Kind of revenue agency is going to send you $425.10 in your dreams. So again, watch out for scams on email, telephone, and text messaging. Okay, next up we have a share from Chris. I think this one is hot off the press, Chris.
Yeah, this is a strange one. It happened to me today, first time ever. I went to YouTube and it came up with this notice that ad blockers are not allowed on YouTube. And I just clicked the X rather than saying allow YouTube ads, and certainly I wasn't going to try YouTube Premium. I X'd out the thing and I let the video play, and I had no ads. I tried reloading the page, and it reloaded without coming up with this notice. I reloaded it again, and it came up with the notice. So I'm not sure what's going on, whether, you know, it seems to be very inconsistent about whether I get this or not. So I'm curious if anybody else wants to chime in, if all of a sudden they started getting this notice about ad blockers not allowed on YouTube. I'll throw it into the chat, or we can talk about it a little bit later on if you want. But just something to watch out for, and I would actually recommend if you do get it, just hit the X and continue along. And, you know, I don't know how long this is going to work with just clicking on the X, but so far it seems to be working for me. So,
Control-F5.
Control-F5, what does that do? Oh, you muted again, Tom.
It reloads the page.
Oh, okay.
And Alyssa said she looked at a video at 4 o'clock and there was no problem and didn't see the warning. So,
yeah. Very curious. Okay.
There's a at the bottom there, if you don't have an ad blocker, you can report the issue.
Well,
that's what it says at the bottom?
Yeah. Now, I think that's just a catch-all that they have just in case they make a big mistake that you can say, hey, I don't have it. They probably will send you a notice saying, well, you do, and here's how you can check if you have an ad blocker. I'm willing to bet. I didn't try that link.
Okay.
Chris, did you go to YouTube through Chrome, or did you use another browser like Firefox or whatever?
I was on Chrome. I tried it in Edge, but I don't have an ad blocker in Edge. So I didn't do very comprehensive testing on it at all. But it was just curiosity at this point in time. But we'll see if it becomes more prevalent or goes away or whatever.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So next up, we have a question from Tom. His new laptop has a microphone on-off switch, but he can't tell whether it's on or off, I guess. So he wants to know if anybody knows how to tell if the microphone's live, or he says even maybe a volume bar chart. So there's a couple of ways you can check your microphone. You look on the web, there are some instructions for both Windows 10 and Windows 11 from Microsoft itself. And basically, they want you to load the sound app in the settings menu. And then you get down to this test your microphone here. So if you start talking to your microphone, then the blue bar may go up and down. If it's like my machine, it's way down at this bottom left-hand end and not terribly useful. However, there's another way to do it, which is very relevant to tonight. If you're using the Zoom app, then if you go to the settings menu in Zoom, in the app, this control cog here, the control wheel, cog wheel, it takes you to the settings. And when you go to the settings, if you drill down to audio, then again, you have one of these test the microphone thing. And this one seems to be a lot more sensitive. And you can adjust the volume and you can see the thing going up and down. And there's also the option to test the microphone and then replay it. Of course, that only works if you have the Zoom app. Now, the thing that that Tom maybe wanted was a volume chart. And so here's a site which has a whole raft of audio level metering systems. It's quite an old site. I think the last time it was updated was 2012 or maybe 2014. So it's pretty well 10 years old. But if you download one of these things, I downloaded this one on the left here and ran it on my machine just the other day. And even though the software is 10 years old, it works really, really well. So once you load the app on your desktop, you talk to the microphone and the volume levels bounce up and down quite nicely and telling you the microphone is actually on, I guess, and how much it's on too. So Darkwood Designs is the website for downloading those meter level apps. Okay, next up we have Linda on her part 4 of photo editing with Photoscape X. And today she's going to talk about masking and cloning. Wherever she is.
She's muted.
Thanks, Alan. So hopefully you can see my screen.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So as Alan mentioned, we're going to do masking and cloning. I've opened up the paid version of Photoscape X, but it is not required to do masking. It's just I'm not going to bounce back and forth tonight, and it is required for the cloning. So I'm just going to drag my gallery over to the left. So if anybody wants to do that now, everything I'm going to talk about will be on the right side of your screen. Okay, so I'm just going to drag in the first image. And when we were adjusting color light, we go to the color tab. And in this particular image, you might think, well, you know, the crew member's face is a little dark, so let's lighten shadows and see what happens. Well, that's great. His face becomes better, but I've lost the nice dark shadows of the green and the blue that I like on the water because he's backlit. So this happens in a lot of situations where you're taking pictures of your family or whatever. If they're backlit at all, their faces are going to be shadowed. So all we really want to do is lighten his face, not the rest of the photo. So I'm just going to go down here to the mask button, click on that. It defaults to a brush, which is what we're going to use. And you can then adjust the brush size. I'm going to zoom in. You can do it with this bar at the bottom, or you can do your control scroll wheel and just navigate over here. And then I'm just going to hover over his face. So to mask, you just left click and hold. So it's like you're painting and you can let go and start again. You don't have to get a cramp or anything. And so I'm just going to paint his face here. And you don't have to go right to the edge. In fact, it's better if you don't, because you don't have to be too careful. I'm not going to put that much light on his face that you would notice it. But if you do go off to the edge, you're really going to notice it if I lighten this and then this becomes light too. If you make a mistake like that, just click on the minus brush and paint back over that there so that you're not having your trees affected. So then I usually just click back on the plus brush and we'll just quickly do his hands. You could do his shirt too or whatever you wanted. So now we can show the mask with this button at the bottom. And in this program, the mask is where you're going to make an adjustment in this case of lighting. So it's kind of a bit of a misname thing, because to me a mask is covering. But anyway, this is how the program has worked. The mask area is where the adjustment is going to take effect. So I'm just going to click off the show mask so we can see the effect. And I'm just going to drag the brighten bar over about halfway, maybe 3/4, so you can see it. And you can see that his face is now much brighter. We'll do the compare. There's the before and there's the after. So it didn't affect the rest of my image. And so now I've got something that is a lot more balanced in terms of lighting and exposure. Okay, the second one I'm going to show you is in masking, but not with respect to lighting. So we're on the homepage now, the edit screen, and we're going to go to adjustments. And I want to blur the background a bit, just to soften the intensity of that background, because in this type of image, it's more about the faces. So you can see as soon as I clicked on blur, the face is blurred a bit, and you can take it all away you want. But in this instance, you can either mask the background, and that will keep the faces clear. Or it's probably faster to mask the faces and invert. So I'm going to show you how to do that. So I'm going to click on the mask. I don't know what background I'm going to want yet, but if I'm just looking at the background now, I don't want it too blurred, because then you really have to do a close, very carefully masking. But we'll do it about that much. So I'm going to click on the mask, and now I'm just going to paint the faces. And then we'll invert the mask. So I'm just going to do the faces for now, just in the interest of time. And as I say, if you don't blur your background too much, you don't have to get every exact hair into your mask. If you go really extreme on your blur, then yes, you have to get every hair or it looks funny. So I'm just going to do mine quickly. As I say, you can stop and click and start again. I'm going to get a bigger brush and cover my face up here. Okay, so basically I want to protect the faces. You of course would do the shirt as well, but just I'll just do the faces. Okay, so now if we blur, it's a mask, so it's only going to affect the faces. So what we want to do is invert it. Now you can see when I have a very emphasized blur, you would have to go back and get that edge really good with the hair. But if you just kind of don't do it too much, just a slight blur. I'll do the before and after. There's the compare. I've blurred it, just not too much. You don't have to be as careful with the edges of hair. But that's totally up to you how much time you want to spend. But it's a good little tool to have. Okay, so the last thing I want to show on this image is the way you can use the masks. You can use in almost any function in this software, which I really like. So we're going to get out of the blur. We're going to go back into the color. I'm just going to zoom in to the right of this photo. And say you just wanted to touch up somebody's teeth. I'm just going to mask my sister's teeth there. Just a quick little draw and just give her a little bit of whitening. And that's it. So there's the before and there's the after. So just a little touch up. So very quick to use the masking tool. And as I say, any of the most of the functions you find in the software, you can apply a mask. Okay, so I'm going to move on to cloning.
So Linda, a question here. Does masking work in the free version?
Yes, masking is available in all the functions in the free version, yes. So now I'm going to go on to cloning, and that is only available in the paid version, which is around $70 Canadian. So I'm just going to bring in that we're going to come back to this image too, because one of the things in this image is our eye always goes to very bright objects. Well, I don't really want that in there. It's not really adding anything that you can pay attention to napkins. So I'll come back in and maybe clone that out. But I wanted to start with this one for the cloning. So to clone, we're going to go to the tools where we were last week when we did the spot healing brush and the skin soften, and we're going to go right down to the bottom. And on the free version, you'll see it'll say Clone Brush Pro because they want you to see what you're missing. So we'll click on the clone stamp, and I'm just going to zoom in again here. And what I want to do is I want to get rid of that red umbrella. It's really nice that the Lockman and Lock Ladies have these umbrellas now, because when I was growing up on the locks in the 60s and 70s, they just all got skin cancer. And now it's really great that they're under these umbrellas, but I kind of didn't want it in my photo. So I'm just going to zoom in, and I want to get rid of that umbrella. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just go out to this area where I know I can copy some of these trees over top of this umbrella, and probably nobody's going to notice. So I'm going to choose a fairly big brush, plunk it there, say. I always make sure for this type of thing that the hardness is set to zero. If you set it to 200, that's fine. When you're cutting a very fine edge, it gives a very clean border. But on this, I don't want it to be a tough edge. I want it to kind of blur in. And you just, you left click on, you sort of anchor it. So I'll just go through that again. So you anchor it by left clicking. And then you just move your mouse over. I'm not touching my mouse other than just moving it. And then you left click again, hold, and you start to paint. Now we're just going to paint these trees in. And you have to be careful about what I call chattering, when, you know, the eye can really see that you've repeated. So be careful about that. There's lots of ways you can get around that. And then we're going down here. Now here, you want to make sure that you're really lined up well with what you're copying. I'm going to copy the picnic table. And sometimes you have to start again. If your brush is too close, it will remember what's underneath. So I'm just going to hit apply just in case that's the, and I'm just going to, sometimes you have to just go back in and start again. I'm just going to click it from here, make that my anchor point now, and carry on through here. But you see, it's copying that because it remembers. So we just hit apply and take the new information, try and leave the guy's bow line. Anyway, you can fix that up later. And then you can just make sure you're lined up so that I can just whip down here and get rid of anything in the water there. And I'll probably just go down here. Now, here's where you might want to add a bit of hardness, slightly softer, a slightly smaller brush, just to get in tight there if you wanted to. But frankly, I don't think anybody's going to notice that. So I'm going back out. So now it's more the scene I wanted. I'm going to hit apply. Well, I won't have to hit apply. We just do a before and after here, and it doesn't take long. As I say, just make sure you haven't got trees that look repetitive. Just do a bit more cloning to mix it up a bit. Okay, so that's that kind of situation. Now I'm going to do one more example with typical family shot. So we've got, you know, the wine glass, we got the Sprite can, things you just don't necessarily want to have in your shot. So I'm going to go to edit, and I'm going to crop it first off and see what can I fix just by cropping. Well, I don't need my whole sister's elbow, so we're going to crop out the wine glass, and we're going to do sort of balance to the same amount of space to the right of me. But, you know, there's nothing I can do about the Sprite can, so let's clone that out. So I'm just going to zoom in. And the thing to remember with cloning is if you're cloning in an area that's the face or the person, then people are going to notice things. But if you're in an area that isn't important to the photo, then most of the time for a quick image, nobody's going to notice. So I'm going to take this part of my shirt, and I'm going to just drag over here, and I'm going to get rid of this can, and I'm going to go way to the right because I know I'm going to crop it. And then we're just going to copy the napkin and the table. And we'll just get rid of all that. So we've got a new panel on the table, but nobody's going to notice or care. I'm going to hit apply. We're going to zoom back out. And now, oh, I didn't go quite far enough. We'll just do that right here. Okay, that gives me enough space. That gives me enough canvas. And I'll go back to edit. I find my crop, and we can do a final crop. And I'll just go slightly to the left of my fake elbow there. And there you go. And I don't think anyone would ever notice that pop can's gone. Okay, so let's just do one last thing. I will just flip back to the one we started with, and we'll just do a quick little clone out of the napkins. So just zoom in, hit your clone stamp, pick something brown, pick there, start there, drag along. And get rid of that distracting white. Hit apply when you've reached the extent of your copying area, and just keep going. So we hit our extent again, and that just takes out that really distracting. I'm gonna probably get the edge of my area. So let's go back out, and so there's the original, and there's after. So again, it's just bringing attention to your faces. You could go back in, just mask that and really blur it if you wanted to. You can also do all sorts of things, but the whole idea is to draw attention to the people and not the background. So that's all I have. If there's any questions in the chat, Alan,
there's nothing
there.
Chris is just noting that there's an older version of Photoscape, not Photoscape X, that does have the clone stamp.
Yes, it is, but it's a really clunky version of Photoscape, and in anything I've been showing you, it's not available. It's a completely different looking program. So yes, if you really don't want to buy the paid version, you can go back to the older version and just use the clone brush, but I wouldn't recommend using any of the other tools because they're so much better in the new free version. So I think Chris was going to mention too that, I'll just stop sharing here, that I am available for one-on-one if anybody wants it. I know you can't really learn a program just in a Zoom, but if anybody wants to Zoom with me or whatever, I'm very happy to go one-on-one and help you with your photos and teach you how to use some of these tools. So again, the paid version is around $70 Canadian, and it's a one-time deal. You can put it on 10 different computers, and there's no subscription. I bought it 5-6 years ago, and I've never had to pay another cent.
And Linda's contact information is in the chat window.
Elizabeth's asking if the new clones have any marker that indicates they've been modified.
No, not in this program, not that I'm aware of. I can, if you submitted a photo to a competition and they said no cloning allowed, or if it was the photojournalism when you're just not allowed to do any kind of editing, they will find it because you just have to zoom in to pixel by pixel type thing. It's really easy to spot where you're going to do a clone. You count on the fact that it's in the background or it's not, people aren't blowing this photo up to, you know, huge poster size. But in terms of actually labeling it as such, no.
Okay, thanks, Linda.
You're welcome.
Okay, so next up we have a special correspondent from Shawinigan and his cat.
My cat. Well, I guess I'm going to have to talk a little bit because it's only half worked. So I have a bookmark on my computer, a folder. It's labeled unsorted bookmarks. And I would call this the equivalent of my digital kitchen junk drawer. Every stupid thing I trip over on the web while I'm browsing and I don't have time to look at right away, I save it into unsorted bookmarks. And maybe I get to it later. Maybe not. There's all kinds of stuff in there. It gets pretty bad to the point where I have to actually do mass deletes of stuff sometimes. And just before I mass deleted everything the other day, I found Irion, or Irion. How do you spell that? Irion.com. Irion for Windows and Mac or Linux. And this was a little application that you are supposed to put on your Android phone, and then you put a client on a desktop PC of some sort, and it allows you to wirelessly connect your Android to your computer's video chat client, whatever it may be, like this thing we're using now. What's it called? Zoom, or Skype, or Meet, or, you know, whatever floats your boat. The test went well. I did the thing that Alan demonstrated with the microphone, where you go in and you test the microphone and make sure the sound works. And I did the same thing for the video, and everything worked great until I tried it with you guys tonight. And the video seemed to work really well. The audio was not coming out the way it should have. And I don't know why yet, but that's going to give me something to work on for the rest of the week. Although it's in my junk drawer, so I may not get to it right away. But the video seemed to work really well, so I have hopes of getting this going. Of course, if somebody else gets it installed, you know, they could try and sort it out for me.
What kind of resolution did you get, Stu?
Pardon me, Tom?
What kind of resolution did you get?
I have no idea. But I was counting nose hairs. So, you know.
Your cat has nose hairs?
I was using it on an Android Samsung A8 from 2018 using the selfie cameras. It has 16 megapixel and a 8 megapixel cameras for the selfie, and it was getting very nice resolution, but I didn't see a number or try and measure it anyway. The software is not that fancy. So anyway, it may be helpful to people who don't have a webcam for their device. My next step was to try it on my laptop, but I'd have to find the laptop to do that. So, you know.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. Sounds like it might be, as you say, a use for those old phones that have no security updates anymore. Okay, moving along, we have another loony bit from Stuart, but this is one that Chris has taken under his wing and has a lot more comments about it.
Yeah, so, Stuart pointed it out as a neat thing that you can actually get Canadian Cloud Storage if you care about where your data is actually stored. So they'll give you 5 gigabytes for free. The next tier seems to be 2 terabytes, and that'll cost you $96 a year, Canadian. It's been around a long time, so they claim to have been around for 10 years, which is usually a good thing, that something has got some longevity behind it. So you can access your cloud storage either through a web browser, or they have clients for Windows, Android, iOS, so Apple phones and tablets, or Mac OS, Apple desktop and laptops. It allows you to share files and folders. Some of the features of it, you can recover deleted files for up to 30 days. They say more with a paid account. They don't say how much more. You have version history. So it's unknown. They don't seem to specify anywhere on their website exactly the time period that the version history is there. It might go hand in hand with recovering of deleted files of 30 days. But you do have some version history at least. And it has got one of the best privacy policies that I've read on any site on the web. They're very clear about what their privacy policy is all about. And that makes sense because they're really touting the idea that this is Canadian cloud storage. Your files are being stored on servers that are in Canada. Now, in transit, you could cross boundaries for sure, but at least storage is in Canada. Now, before we go on, I will point out that anybody who is concerned about being subject to U.S. Disclosure and things like that, well, every country has disclosure capabilities that are built into legislation. So Canada is no different. If the government wants to come after you, they will find a way. Next. So if we take a look at accessing it just through a web browser, you go to sync.com, and here's the site that, or the cloud storage that I set up, and the main functions are over on the right-hand side, so you can upload files, or you can create a new shared file or new folder. You can create a file, which it has the major Microsoft format files. It can create an empty file, Word file or PowerPoint or whatever. And I'll come back to the show deleted files in a bit. So next. So I'm pointing at one file there, so 2023 Cyber Threat Report PDF. And if I click on that, it comes up with a window, and that window will show you a little bit more details about it. So it gives you the size, and it gives you the date of the file, and so forth. Next. And you can click on open, and it'll open it up in a separate window, so they can view quite a few file types, PDFs, graphics, all of the Microsoft file types will come up in a window within your browser. Next. So on free accounts, anyone with the link can view and download. And you'll see that you have, so you click on the share, and you get a share as a link, and you click on that, and it'll give you a link that you can distribute with other people. You can email people right from there with the link, or you can copy it to your clipboard and paste it into an email or whatever you have to do. Next.
So, Chris, is that for files and folders?
Yep. So if you go to the link settings, it gives you a little bit more information. They have a big part of upgrade to get these extra features. And typically, I didn't care about most of those expiry dates on the link and things like that. They may be of use to some people, but I don't find them particularly necessary or interesting even. You know, email notifications on people that actually click the link and so forth could be useful. Download count stats and so forth. But you can go in, you can set a password. So because this link is accessible to anybody who has that link, you can put a password on it, and when they try to access it, they'll get prompted for the password. You can actually change the label on it, so you can come up with another descriptive name. Next. So there's your password site. You can also delete the link once you no longer want to share it. As soon as you click on delete link, the link becomes invalid. Next. Now there's a whole bunch of things about permissions. And you see that it's highlighted on, or the selected thing is view and download. So that's the default, is that it allows anybody with that link to be able to view and download the file. If it's password protected, they have to know that. There are options for view only without being able to download, or view, download, and edit. And they say for authenticated users only. I'm presuming that would have to be other people that actually have an account on the site. But that only works if you have a paid version of this. So if you go in and you change it to view only, or view, download, and edit, and you save settings, you go back in, it'll be changed back to view and download. So on a free account, you only have the view and download as an option. Next. So this is something that I ran into, which I was well into this, and I would have almost abandoned this entire looking at it if I realized this was a limitation of free accounts. You can only have 3 links on free accounts. And as soon as you try to create a 4th link, it comes up and tells you that free starter, and they call it a sync starter plan, allows you to create a maximum of 3 links. So if you need more, you have to go to a paid account. But I was already well into this, so I continued on and completed the presentation. Next. So if you want to do it from the client for Windows, what this allows you to do is synchronize between the cloud and a folder on any computer that you install this client for Windows onto. So you can see here I installed it, and it comes up, and it gives you, first thing it wants to do is either create a new sync account or use an existing one. So if you've already created it, you'll get prompted to log into the account. Next. And then the one thing that you can really change is the sync folder location. So we'll normally put it under your profile directory. So /users/ and your username. And then below that will be a sync folder, S-Y-N-C folder. But you can move it to another location if you want to. Next. And then it'll install a tray icon, which will allow you to access functions within the program. Next. So if you click the tray icon, it'll come up with a box that it shows you some of the recent activity on your sync account. Next. You can click on the cloud to actually access it through a web browser. So it'll open up a web browser on that site. Next. It'll allow you to open that local folder, so C users, C Taylor in my case, /sync as the default one, so it'll just open that folder and you can interact with the files there. Next. Or you can go to the gear icon, which will allow you to, you know, do various functions on that. So next. One of the things you can do is get to the preferences, and there's a whole plethora of different functions that you can set within the preferences dialog box. Nothing terribly interesting, but if you do use it, I suggest take a look at the different tabs and see what they can do for or against you. Next. So if you wanted to access your files via the folder on your computer, so I have here a copy of File Explorer, and you can see it's highlighted on the sync folder, which is under it's actually pinned as to the quick access automatically for you, but you can also access it through this PC, you know, your drive C, users, your username, and then sync. And what you can do once you get there is you can add additional folders, you can delete folders from that, you can edit files that are in that folder, and all of those will get synced automatically to the cloud. And then if you have other computers where you've accessed, you've installed the client software, it'll automatically synchronize any changes down to those other computers as well. I find this really, really handy. I use this with Google Drive, and I have Google Drive client installed on all my computers. That means that when I'm working on presentation files, they're on every computer as well as in the cloud, and I can edit them on any computer. And it'll automatically synchronize those changes to all the other computers. I find it really, really handy. Next. So there are sharing options on the right-click menu. So if you right-click on a particular file, next, it'll give you the option to share the link. So it'll set up that that URL and allow you to, you know, well, it automatically copies it to your clipboard, so you can then paste it into an email or whatever to send it to somebody else, say, here's where you can get this file. Next. And then you can do the manage sync link from the right-click menu as well, and that basically brings you up that same dialog box that we saw earlier when accessing it through the web browser. This is a web browser that it brings up a window showing how you can manage those settings. Next. Okay, so they have an Android client as well. So I installed it on my Android phone. And it's interesting, by default, the files are not actually stored on your phone, which actually kind of makes sense because you might end up with, gigabytes of files that you're syncing to the cloud, and you don't want to try and push gigabytes of files to your phone. You probably don't have room for it. So you can restrict whether files are accessible via mobile or just on the Wi-Fi, so you don't want to necessarily have synchronization happening over the mobile network. If you're paying extra surcharges and so forth, you can have it that it will only do synchronizations over the Wi-Fi. You can choose to make a file available when you're offline, and it will cache it locally on your phone. And you can copy a file that you see there to local storage on the phone in a non-sync folder. So you could just decide, okay, I do want this JPEG or whatever on my phone. I will just copy it out to another location on my phone, and then it won't be part of that synchronization process at all. And you can see the icons that you get. You get a little blue check mark if the file is available offline. And then if you have it linked for sharing, you'll see a little chain icon on there. Next. And then you can change the options for the file by clicking on the, I think they call it a kebab menu. And you can see over on the right-hand side, you have various options. So you can share that as an attachment. You can, you know, save it to the device. You can mark it to sync it so that it's available offline and so forth. So all those different options are available to you on each file or folder that you actually have in the cloud. Next. So for deleted files, what you do is you go to the folder where the file used to be, and then you click that option, Show Deleted Files. And just note the files are, deleted files are kept for 30 days. And interestingly, they don't count against your quota. Next. So once you're showing deleted files, you can select the files you want to recover. Next. And you click on Restore, and they'll be brought back to the normal. Now, well, first thing that sort of confused me was I got to that point and I tried going back and I couldn't go back, and I clicked on the sync folder and I still wasn't seeing my files. Well, next, the important thing you have to do is say hide deleted files, and then you'll see all your normal files. So until you do that, you're only looking at deleted files. Next. So the versioning. As I say, they don't tell you how long they're kept for or how many versions you can actually store. But interestingly, again, they don't count against your quota. Next. So to get to that, you select the file. Next. And you click version history. Next. And then you will see all versions of that particular file are listed. Next. And then you can click on a version, and it will actually, if you click on any version that you see there, it'll actually download it to your downloads directory on your computer. Next. And then if you want to restore it and overwrite the version that is the current version, you click that on the restore button, and it will replace the current version with that archived version or the previous version that you had of it. Next. So my conclusions, it is pretty capable cloud storage. It's hosted in Canada for anybody that makes a difference for. You do get 5 gigabytes for free, and you can pay for tiered storages after that. You can access it through the web browser or local folders if you're on Windows, Android, iOS, or macOS with client software that you install on your computer. You can recover deleted files, which don't count against quota. You can do file versioning, which doesn't count against your quota. And you can share files and folders through web links. But, and this is a big one for me, only 3 links at a time in a free tier. So if that matters to you, take a look probably at something else like Google Drive or OneDrive, which will allow you not only more storage, but it'll also allow you to link indefinite or any number of links that you want to your shared files. But I found it kind of interesting. So that's it.
Thanks, Chris. Carol's wanting to know if any of the cloud storage systems have a country code. I think most of them are .com, but are you aware of any that have a country code as the URL?
If I'm not mistaken, I think Google will let you use .ca anywhere. It's all the same thing. It's just that it's pointing to the same location. Unless you actually are told by the site where it's hosted, I wouldn't count on knowing where it's hosted. It could be Ireland. It could be the United States. It could be anywhere unless they actually tell you. So even if you have a .ca URL, that's no guarantee that your data is actually stored in Canada.
And Tom was asking if you can point a folder to your OneDrive folder.
I don't know. Might get really confusing if you try and do something like that. I suppose that you could actually bury your sync folder underneath OneDrive. That would certainly work. So when you install the client, you could actually tell it, you know, in my case, /users/ctaylor/OneDrive/sync. And that would put that under there. So it would be both under sync as well as it would be backed up through OneDrive. So I guess you could do it that way.
And Glenn is asking if sync works on a Linux computer.
They don't have a local client for it. So if you're using it on a Linux computer, you'd be limited to a web browser access for it.
Okay, so thanks, Chris. So lots of stuff there for people to look at. Okay, so just a note, we're coming up to the last 10 minutes. I have one more item here. I've got way more than 2 minutes worth of material, but I can cut it short if we want to. So if anybody has any other questions, put them in the chat, and Chris will be monitoring that, and we'll put out the big hook and reel me in if
okay.
we need to.
Will do.
Okay, so going back to this look at PC Manager and trying to speed up old computers, and so far we've looked at the health check and the storage management. The next item on the agenda is this process management. And if you click on that, then it basically shows you, I think you can get to this in the settings as well, it basically shows you what processes are actually running and allows you to turn them off. So here you can see I've got Microsoft PowerPoint running. Well, that's because I was making these slides as I made the screenshots. I'm also running Glasswire, which is a firewall program, so I don't want to turn that off. But there's Microsoft PhoneLink. Now, personally, I don't link my phone to Microsoft. I don't use it on the PC, so I could quite happily turn that one off, for example. Going down the screen here, you'll notice I got real-time sync running. That's Chris's fault because he told us how to use real-time sync to do instant backups. So that is running on my system to do backups. But I've also got some Macrium products running. There's a UI watcher, for example. As I told you before, Macrium is out of date, basically. They're going to discontinue it, I think, at the end of this year, maybe next year. But it's a program which I've basically already replaced. So I could quite easily disable those and, in fact, uninstall Macrium altogether. Java update scheduler is an interesting one. You get updates for Java once in a blue moon, so I don't really think I need it running all the time. Interestingly enough, I tried to update it, and I got this message which says, well, you haven't updated Java, you haven't used Java for 8 months. Do you really want to keep it, or shall we delete it? So I said, sure, you can delete it. And then the final one in the list here, I think, is Microsoft SharePoint, which is a function of Microsoft 365, which allows you to exchange all kinds of information with colleagues, which I don't do, so... Again, that's one I could probably get rid of, but I'm not sure really what it does, so it may do things that I really want. You can also monitor the startup applications, so if you've got things which are loading at boot time, you can turn those off. And for example, you can see I've turned off Microsoft OneDrive because I use Dropbox. I never use OneDrive. Some of the other things, there's Macrium Reflect again, that could go. Some of the other ones I use, like Glasswire again, is a firewall, I want that running. The monitor application for my brother printer, I probably don't need to monitor my brother printer because I use it very rarely, so that could be one that could be disabled. moving along, you remember that these two icons on the bottom here, cleanup and security, are really tabs. So this takes you to the main menu, and this takes you to this security menu over here where you can update browser settings, repair the taskbar, and manage pop-ups. So if you start off by hitting the scan button, and it basically does an instant scan using Microsoft Defender, it starts scanning a whole bunch of different areas, and if you leave it for a little while, then it will tell you it's scanned almost 50,000 files and didn't find any threats, which is quite reasonable because I've got Defender running all the time, and so there shouldn't be any threats that Defender can find anyway. Windows Update is an interesting one. It allows you to do an instant update, and it tells me that there's an update for Windows 10, 2023-08. There was a virus definitions update and a whole raft of driver updates, which are interesting because when I actually go to update in the settings menu, there's the 2023-08 update for Windows 10. And it doesn't show the virus scan update and it doesn't show any of the driver updates. So I'm not quite sure what to make of that. But you can access update from PC Manager if you so wish. A couple of other things in the list here. Default browser settings. And notice the current setting is Vivaldi. And if you click on this, it says it prevents other programs from modifying the default browser. You'll notice that my default browser is Vivaldi. And if I hit on change here, it wants to change it to, of course, Microsoft Edge, which I don't want to do, so I'm happy to cancel that. I can repair the taskbar, and you notice it wants me to turn on the news and interests, the Edge icon on the taskbar, and the Microsoft Store icon on the taskbar, all of which I have very carefully removed because I don't use them and I don't want them, so I have no interest in clicking on repair. That's not a particularly useful option to me. And then the final one is pop-up management. So it's basically some kind of ad blocker, I guess. But I have an ad blocker in my browser already, so I decided not to turn that thing on. So just in summary, when we've looked at this thing for a number of weeks, it will get rid of multiple files in order to free up disk space, but we always found that we had to run this cleanup to get rid of the regular and the system files that Microsoft knows about. It can be useful to find large files, and you can look at the installed apps, but again, that's really just a settings type function. And you can go to Storage Sense if you're interested. You can look at current processors, Windows Defender, you can run an instant scan. You can run an instant Windows update. You can change the browser settings if you wish, having changed them already. You can so-called repair the taskbar to where Microsoft would like it to be repaired to, and some kind of pop-up block system. So once the smoke clears, once you've done all that, once you've cleaned up all the disk space and got rid of the apps and cleaned up the startup applications and that kind of thing, you remember we started off with my old XPS 8300 desktop, and the yardstick was a boot time of 27 seconds, which wasn't that bad, but it's not exactly rapid these days. When I cleaned things up, I started off with about 61 gig of disk storage space. I actually revised my partitions from the very first time I did this and gave myself a lot more space in the Windows drive. But when I started this exercise, I had 61 gig free on the Windows system. When I cleaned everything up, I freed up 8 gigabytes of disk space. And when I ran the the boot to desktop check again, it went from 27 seconds to just 19 seconds. So I saved myself 8 seconds, which is, in my case, is 30%. Now, I don't know whether you get 8 seconds, and I don't know whether you get 30%, but clearly you get some kind of benefit from following all those different pathways to success. So does it work as advertised? When Chris looked at this, first of all, it was promising a one-click tune-up system. It certainly doesn't do that, but it does do a fairly good job at cleaning a whole bunch of stuff up. So where do we go next? Well, if you remember Chris's note in a presentation which he gave to the club quite a while ago, he had a whole raft of things here in this list. Some of the ones we've looked at, this clutter, for example, auto-starting programs, but a whole bunch of these things we haven't really taken a look at. So maybe we'll follow up on that and see what we can do even further. And I have a computer coming in from a friend of mine that she says is really slow. That might make a really good test. So we'll see how that goes. So we have a few minutes for other questions. Anything in there, Chris?
No, I have just a couple of comments. Yes, out-of-date drivers would be interesting. And we have a comment from Stu that Vivaldi has released an iOS app. I think that's about it. I can put in a pitch for tomorrow night if anybody's interested. I am giving a presentation at the Ottawa Public Library's Centennial Branch out in the West End, Keeping Passwords Safe. There are 5 people registered so far, so it will happen. So you don't have to register at the OPL website. Definitely the presentation will be going ahead. However, the library probably would appreciate you registering if you are interested. And I will paste into the chat. We have a total of 25 presentations that are coming up over the next couple of months at various branches of the OPL. So if you're interested in any of those, the link to our website is on the chat right now. And you can go to the Ottawa Public Library website to register for any of them. I do suggest that you register for them, because it's not that I take attendance, but if nobody's registered, I won't be there. So if you are interested in any of them, please do register with the Ottawa Public Library.
And Chris, are there scheduled presentations at branches all across the city?
They're at, a total of 8 different branches. So we have Centennial, Blackburn Hamlet, Greeley, Emerald Plaza, Sunnyside, Orleans, Rideau, Saint Laurent, Ruthie Dickinson, North Gloucester, I think that's Alta Vista branch. So I think those are all the branches.
So you got lots of presentations at lots of different branches, and Carol says, thank you for coming to Greeley.
Well, hope to see you there, Carol. I think Greeley has got 4 presentations.
Wow. Okay, thanks, Chris. So next week is October the 11th. That will be our regular monthly meeting for the club. Bob Walker is going to be giving a talk on autonomous vehicles, or as it says here, self-driving cars. If you're interested in self-driving cars, then that's not to be missed. However, it means that next week there will be no Q&A. We don't have question and answer sessions on regular meeting nights. So our next Q&A will be on the 18th. So that gives you 2 weeks to think up of your questions, prepare your chairs to present to the group, and send us a note to suggestion box, and we'll be sure to add you to the agenda for the 18th.
And I have one in the queue. I have one in the queue for 2 weeks out already, which is kind of an amusing one on AI and image creation. So that'll be a little bit of a humorous item that is guaranteed to be out in 2 weeks.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So we'll see you all next week at the regular meeting, self-driving cars, and send us your information for Q&A on the 18th. Thanks for attending. I hope you found it interesting. And that's it for me.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you at the monthly meeting next month, and then 2 weeks in Q&A.